Hello, and welcome to another episode of eDiscovery Chicks, the podcast about all things eDiscovery and legal tech, hosted by two gals who are really, really jazzed about today's guests. Anyways, we're your hosts. That's Bree.
And that's Angie. And today we are continuing our EDRM series. We are now on production. And Angie and I did do a recording of production a couple of weeks ago, but we really had to call in the experts. So tonight we are joined by two special guests. Nate Audi and Dan Olmos are here joining us. Both of them are with United Lux. So I'd like to just take a moment to introduce them to you all. Nate Audi is a senior project manager at United Lux. He specializes in e-discovery. He has maybe one of the most diverse backgrounds I've ever run into in my e-discovery career. And that's saying a lot, actually, because most people in e-discovery have a little bit of a rocky road before we found the good stuff. He started his career off as a full-time martial arts instructor, which everybody knows when you're performing martial arts that the next thing you want to do is become a pastor. So that's what Nate did. But after a decade or so of working in the ministry and nonprofit organizations, he found himself in need of a change, and he stumbled into the world of e-discovery, which, by the way, Nate, I want to hear that story one day after a couple martinis. Nate has now worked in client services at United Lux for about 4.5 years, managing programs and projects across the board, from tiny claims to large-scale MDLs. He's also been a bit of an intellectual sponge and tries to know a little bit of enough about everything in the e-discovery world, which I can say all of that last statement, Nate, is a huge understatement. You are a powerhouse when it comes to knowledge in the e-discovery world and project management. Okay, so that's Nate. Dan Olmos, also aka Dano, don't anybody say Bookum. He is a seasoned project manager specializing in e-discovery, also at United Lux. He has had a distinguished career. He's worked for several prominent vendors such as Novitas Data, Discovery Legal, Advanced Discovery, which is now Concilio, and Fios, which was acquired by DTI. I mean, it's like maybe the better question is like, have you not worked for someone, Dan? With over a decade of experience in the legal technology sector, Dan excels in managing complex projects from inception to completion. Outside of work, Dan is exploring the Pacific Northwest because he lives in beautiful Oregon with his wife and his two huskies. And he often likes to travel, sail, and immerse himself in the natural beauty of the outdoors. And he's drinking whiskey, just for anybody who's taking notes. Nate, Dan, thank you very much. And before you say anything, I do have to add, because now I've done the business end of it, but now I get to do the personal end of it. In my life in eDiscovery, I did have a brief hiatus where I got to enjoy life at United Lux, and I was a project manager. Never underestimate how hard the role of a project manager is. That's one of the most fucking hard jobs that are out there.
Your job is hurting cats.
Not only that, all your cats are pissed. Their claws are out. They're ready to fight, and they have extremely high expectations. But that is a very hard job, and it takes a very special person to be able to do it well. And I will tell you that Nate and Dan both perform this job to amazing expertise. And if I were anyone needing a project manager, I would totally put my life in the hands of either one of these gentlemen. The second thing I will say is you guys know how involved with women in e-discovery I am and how much I love to promote women in this industry. Well, one of the things that's always been hard is to have men in the industry who are okay empowering women. And I will tell you that both Nate and Dan, on many occasions personally that I can attest to, give themselves of their time, they've given their wisdom, they've given their expertise to me personally and to many other women and others in their workplace. And I have a lot of respect for that. So I really appreciate you guys taking the time to be here. Not only personally, I feel honored that you're here because I have a lot of respect for you both as people and for your expertise, but I appreciate you being here on the eDiscovery Chicks podcast because we're all about trying to educate people on eDiscovery. And we want to hear from the people that really get it done every day who know what the hell they're talking about. So appreciate you guys being here. Okay. Is that enough of an intro?
Fuck your business intro. I want the personal one.
Yeah. I don't know if we can live up to that personal intro. We'll definitely do our best. And no, I mean, it's true. Every male dominated industry, which is a lot of the tech world, has this idea that makes women not as welcome, which is awful. Because I will say most of the best PMs that I've worked with, Dano aside, have been women. Nothing aside, because I think there's an amazing group of male PMs out there, but absolutely want to empower women in industries where they can do crazy awesome things.
All right. Well, we have an icebreaker question, just because I know Dan loves icebreaker questions.
He just got the slightest little furrow of his brow, like, oh no, what's coming?
We are excited about the Olympics in our household. So here's your icebreaker along the Olympics theme. If you were given the physical ability to perform as an Olympian at any one summer sport, what sport would you choose and why?
I guess it's probably multi-layered. So if it's something I could maybe attain on my own in actual life, take me back 12, 15 years, and I could look at judo or karate, or I did martial arts. That was a world I lived in. I was never anywhere near an Olympic level. That's just laughable. But I at least knew what I was supposed to be doing. If we're talking about things that I have zero chance, but it sure would be cool, I would definitely go towards like lacrosse. I absolutely love lacrosse, specifically indoor lacrosse. It's kind of like hockey, but you don't have to not fall over on ice, and you're allowed to hit people in the head, unlike in hockey, which is fantastic. Indoor lacrosse would probably be my choice if we're taking my actual abilities out of it.
All right. Well, what about you, Dano?
I don't know. I don't know how to kick anybody's ass, so probably the track and field or something, men's 5K or anything else, and throwing a javelin or something would be kind of cool.
I don't know. Angie, what would you do?
I'm going badminton.
Oh my God. You are not going badminton.
I'm going badminton. I will fuck people up at badminton. I will come out of nowhere. I love badminton. I have not played in like 20 years.
I would not join you. If I could do anything in the Olympics, though, I would swim. First of all, swimmers have the most fantastic bodies. So if I could be a swimmer, Olympic swimmer, that means I'm fit. Plus, I would have no hair on my body. So that would be amazing. Those are my priorities in life.
So Ryan Lochte, the Olympic swimmer. So he's now on a reality TV circuit. Oh, and he has recently been in a show called The Traitors, which I don't know if anyone has seen. Nate's making a face like you've seen it. It's incredible. Incredible trash. Alan Cumming. It's incredible trash. Heartwarming trash. Alan Cumming in a castle in Scotland wearing fabulous outfits. And people, you're basically playing like a murder mystery of sorts. And Ryan Lochte is randomly in it, and it's incredible.
Interesting.
So anyway, turns out you can pivot from an Olympic swimming career to a castle in Scotland.
Well, you probably have to, because you can't keep that shit up for life. I mean, come
Absolutely
on.
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
Badminton, though. That's forever.
Badminton's for life.
You
Badminton's
can.
For Bad, life.
That's for
Absolutely.
Life. Yeah. Shall we move this beautiful conversation on to eDiscovery? I hate to do that because this
what
is
to
so much
say.
Fun.
I mean, but it's have over.
For the sake of everyone's sake, we got to get this done before Dan finishes his glass of whiskey.
I have seen pictures of many a bottle. I'm not concerned.
He's drinking whiskey from an official glass, and there's no rocks or anything in that glass. And he's drinking with such class. Like, I almost want to put him in a tuxedo and give him a cigar right now. Just for those of you that can't.
Absolutely do. Should we talk workflows?
Oh, yay. That's a great transition. Yes.
Yeah, that was a hard left. That was not a graceful transition. We're in our first season, guys. Give us a little bit of slack. As everyone on this call knows, making eDiscovery approachable and digestible is central to our mission here at eDiscovery Chicks. So I want to start real basic. Like, let's level set. How and why would someone engage an eDiscovery service provider?
The how, let's say you're starting from ground zero. Obviously, your internet research is going to be where you want to start.
With the Google?
Yeah, I guess. You start from there. And then I would probably look at the biggest companies. And then I would probably take it a step further and get into like LinkedIn and find out who works at these places, if you know anyone, and talk to them first. Yeah, that's probably how I'd get involved if I didn't know at all how to find a vendor. There are lots of them, and they're not all the same.
Why would you hire somebody?
The why is because you're working in the legal world, I assume, or you are legal world adjacent, or you wouldn't be reaching out to us. And you don't know the part of eDiscovery. That's the reason you're looking. You should hire someone because our job is to do that part. I do not practice law. I never will. Thank God. I have zero interest. And it's the thing that I always say when people talk about the background. And I'm like, this is important to me, but I will never code a document for you. And I will never think about the content because that's not my place. You're hiring an eDiscovery vendor because you want someone who knows how to do what you don't. You go kick ass in the courtroom, right? Do the things you need to do and let us make sure that your documents are treated right, your defensibility is high, your forensics analysis, if you need it, or your at least your ability to say, we know this is forensically sound. It was collected the right way. No one can argue with this. That's why we're here. So I think the why is exactly why you should hire a plumber to do your plumbing.
It's also a job within itself. I mean, you might think, oh, I could do this. This is easy. I just have to collect this data. And you go down these rabbit holes and you find out there's a lot more to it. It really is an entire different job than what you already have on your plate, keeping everything defensible. You don't want to spoil any data. You want to collect everything and not miss things. Even when you are given data, like, these companies will help you find missing pieces too. Like if anything's been deleted, there's date range gaps in your data. Mm-hmm. So if you don't have the time to do it, I would definitely recommend outsourcing for sure.
Yeah, I feel like that's a big thing with companies these days. Like an internal legal department isn't built to handle the volume that a vendor is also.
And you don't want the liability either. I mean, yeah. Let's say you fuck something up. I mean, that's on you, not another company.
You know? Yep.
You want to be able to turn around and sue somebody for that.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. You want to look back and say, you broke our contract. You did it wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And Dan's one that's really good at this too. You just said this yourself, Dan, but just to elaborate on it, you don't know what you're missing because you're not looking at it from the eyes of someone who's done this for a million years or who does this every day. When you hire a vendor like a Dan or a Nate, they're going to be like, hey, so why this gap here? Or why are these labeled different? Or it seems like something's missing here. They're going to point out things that you didn't even know was wrong. And I can guarantee you, if Dan or Nate are asking you that question, something's up and you need to go fix it right now and do it now before we get to production.
Because, yeah.
Yeah.
1,000%.
That's such a big piece because once we get to production, we're at the end. You bring in that vendor at the beginning, right? At the point when you really need everything so we can walk you through to the end.
I've seen before where they thought they had everything produced and you go back to the drawing board and you realize that, you know, you missed a few things, like the searches didn't encompass everything they need. And it's sometimes too late to go back for these things. So you really want to make sure that you hire someone who knows what they're doing.
Well, that is a beautiful segue into my next question. We've titled this episode Pencils Down because we understand that that's an important concept for anyone involved in production. So can you explain what Pencils Down means in this context and why it's so important?
Basically, Pencils Down means pencils down. No more editing, no more tinkering, no more reviewing. It's done. Books are closed. So you can't pick the pencils back up mid-process, midstream of a production. You're changing coding, redactions. Things are shifting in that production set and they're going to go out the way you don't want them to go out.
Ship has sailed. Train has left the station.
Exactly. So pencils down for all parties, everybody. I mean, you can't be adding documents to the set either. I mean, you have to tag everything, close it. If everything in that universe has to be done, completed.
So Nate, what can happen if people don't observe pencils down?
that's one of the most common things that happens. And it's hard because most of the time the deadline, we did not set that deadline. You did. Right? You know, we're working within your timeline, but to give you the best possible actual production you need, we need you to go pencils down. So, you know, there's a couple layers of pencil down most of the time. There's your counsel pencils down. And then if we have a review team support, there's our review management pencils down. And then it finally gets to the PM and production team where we're validating and we're looking to make sure things are consistent, to make sure that you're not, you know, coding conflicted families and things like that. And what can happen midstream is if you adjust, let's say you decide, oh no, we redacted too much out of this document, or we didn't redact enough out of this document, and you've already given it to us, then you're going to get a production that contains mismatching information. Either that branding, that information is going to get branded that way, but the coding doesn't match. And so during validations, things don't look right. or it's going to go out without redactions when you thought it had, because you added stuff halfway. And if you think you added it partway through, and we don't know that, you're now opening the door for privilege or PII going out the door that you thought was done, but you never communicated to us. You said, I'm done with my work. You're good to go on the production. And then you made a change. And we're either then rerunning the production, where we're having to go into, you know, a clawback, where we're looking at fixing a problem that never had to exist in the first place. And I think pencils down can be so cleanly done. We work with production schedules with any projects we can. Anyone that we're regularly, we know we've got rolling productions or we've got a planned deadline. They say we need a production in 2 weeks. Then we automatically build out a production schedule. And we say, okay, to get that production on this day of an estimated size, we need you to give it to us at this time. And that means you have to be done. You have to hands off and you have to let it go. Or there's a lower and lower chance that you get that production on time. You're now going to miss your court deadline because you were unwilling to give us the time we have to have to give you the product you need.
So what kinds of tinkering do you see people doing? You know, they give you something like, all right, this is ready for production. And then they're like, oh, wait, just one more thing. What are some common one more things?
Coding changes, coding validations, privilege, priv withheld, additional redactions, you name it. I mean, taking docs out even, or adding a new doc. Oh, I need to add this. Can you process this and add it? Can I have it today? Nope. You just added an entire day to your deadline here.
It almost feels like production is like a really big freight train, and trying to stop it or divert course later on is challenging, has major ramifications, and is just like generally a disaster.
That's a good analogy. You're right. I'd rather have the train not go and be 6 hours late than to try to stop the train somewhere else and
back it up
after that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So.
Yeah. A good way to imagine it with those coding changes, a lot of times it's branding effect or it's content effect, and it will always take so much longer to correct than it will to just delay. It is better to say we're not actually ready for pencils down than it is to say, sure, but have one rogue reviewer in there changing a bunch of stuff.
Yeah. And when you do run into these situations where you are able to, okay, we can just pull this document out. We can update the load file and correct it. It's the same page count. Let's fix it that way. Sure, you can do that once or twice. But when you have clients with these bad habits, your databases start to look like dog shit. There are four different versions of a production. A lot of them have the underscore old or DNU, do not use. You just start looking at this thing 6 months down the road and you've got 20, 30, 40, 60, 80, 100 productions. And then there's each one of them has modifications, underscore R for we change redactions. It's not fun. And it's really hard to go back and try to piece together what happened and why and which version they need to reproduce. You know, they'll ask for documents that was produced in this volume, but there's like six different versions because they made so many changes instead of putting their damn pencils down.
Yeah.
Hold on, because I'm coming. It's going to come full circle. This is going to seem weird at first. So I restored a car. And when I went to deal with the paint part of it, like I wanted to do some body work on it and then get it painted. And I started like sanding down the paint. And the car was silver when I bought it. But before that, it had been blue. And before that, it had been green. And before that, it had been orange. And it took so much longer to sand it all the way down and do all the body work than if whoever had painted it before me had just taken it back down or delayed their thoughts. Like it took so much longer because you had to peel back so many layers of paint.
Yep. Yeah. And it opens confusion. Like Daniel said, like when you're looking back 6 months from now, the question, which version went out? And that should be the easiest answer in the world. We should be able to tell you what you produced. But I've even had situations where, you know, large productions are now being used for another project for the same client, and we're having to transfer. And then we're trying to compare to the coding decisions because it was produced in three different ways. And one has redactions, but one doesn't. Which one do they need? Do they need both? Are we really going to produce the same thing twice again for a different group when we're supposed to not do privilege? It gets so broken and it costs you money. And I think that's the thing that should be the biggest flag. And I used to have a council team member who we nicknamed Scuba Steve. I feel like it's fine if I say that because nobody knows who Scuba Steve is. Your name is Steve out there. It might be you.
I feel like I already know where you're going.
Scuba Steve would ask us to produce, and then review based upon the production deliverable we gave them. And no matter how many times we told them, like, no, you need to make all of the decisions before. We reran every production minimum of 2 times, most of the time 3 or 4. And we talked to them a bunch of times until we finally got on a call and just they're like, okay, we work for the same end client and you are making them pay 3 times. And he's like, what? And it's like, yes, the same thing we've told you before. I got to get this into your head, Scuba Steve. Like, you need to understand, you for 5 docs, you just paid 3 times. So it could be a cheap, small production, but it's not anymore because you've done it so many times. Take your time, know what your production population is, and look at the documents before we produce it.
I think that's a great point that you both are making, and something I honestly didn't have the most appreciation for until I worked with both of you, because it would be like, hey, we have this rolling production for this client, and the production's been going on for a year, say, and you have all those instances like Dan was just referring to. This is version 5. Well, where's version 4? Well, here's the one that was redacted and here's the one that wasn't. Well, shit, we've had turnover in our own organization. We have our own record keeping, but I wasn't here for the first, 3, and then maybe Susie handled the next 3, and then Dan handled the next 4, and then now Bree's involved, and like, what the hell is happening? There's no consistency across the board, and the client is the one that's like bleeding money at this point. Mm-hmm. Because every single time that we have to sit down and figure out, well, what's the _R mean? Was that produced? You're paying money for Dan, and Dan and Nate are expensive people because they're smart and they're really good at what they do. You do not want to pay them more money per hour to help you. I promise.
Nate, I feel like you touched on something really important, which is the value that service providers bring to the table. You know, your Scuba Steve never would have known that the downstream effects of what he was doing, but for your expertise. When you stop and think about it, production is sort of small time-wise compared to the rest of discovery. Most law firms and corporations, they also just don't do it on a daily basis. So that, I feel like, is why an e-discovery vendor is so important. You've got an area of expertise and something that a lot of people don't have exposure to. So can you guys tell me, what are some areas of expertise where a vendor can really be a value add to their client?
Absolutely. As long as you find the right vendor, this is what Dano talked on earlier, right? Like, there's a lot of vendors out there, but the right e-discovery vendor should be able to support you and guide you through the entire EDRM model, the parts you know and the parts you don't. And that's the whole point of the project manager in the vendor, right? Like, we have a ton of support departments and teams that do all the things that Dano and I can't, but we know about them and we can help add value to every step. We've got forensics and preservations teams that can help you with your legal holds. If you have no idea how to put a legal hold, how to collect data in the right way, we have then the next layer when it comes to processing. We've got full processing sets. We're not just opening up emails and looking at them in your own Outlook, right? Which is what you're doing. Or you're having an associate print off, 20,000 pages of emails and you're flipping through them by hand, right? We can process those and provide all of the accurate metadata. We help you through the doc review process. That's the part you're strong at. If you work in the legal world, you know the documents, that's the part you know. But we've got huge teams that can support, reviewing 200,000-300,000 documents in a month basis or less, because we can build out with appropriate people who we vetted for you. We can help you to produce this in the way that you present it to the court, you present it to the plaintiff or to opposing or defendant, whoever you're trying to show your information is accurate to, in a way that you can be confident it has what it needs to have. We've got the workflows. We've got the pieces and parts. Dano, you can talk to so many of the pieces and parts that we do on the PM side.
The thing I would look at first and foremost with the e-discovery company would be, if they're trying to show you how many tools they have and how many bells and whistles and all the cool things they can do with technology.
Smoke and mirrors.
Is a second opinion, because all those processes are done by actual humans like Nate, who's a fucking genius and can sit there and create a custom workflow. But what happens if Nate wants to go have a baby or something? I don't know. Pick a month off.
We have enough, Nate. Come on. I was kidding.
I'll help her. Who knows? These processes, like, the more simple and streamlined a company is, in my opinion, you're going to have a better time. Organization is key. I've been at places that really don't have many organized processes and workflows. Hard to find where things are at. Nothing's consistent. it's just really hard when it's that way. So
talk to me about like how, where can a vendor add value just as far as QCing, you know, what's in, talk to me about what's involved in that and why you're going to need a vendor.
If you think about a production that you've made, we're looking at what you've provided and prepared to deliver somewhere. You've spent weeks, maybe months reviewing these documents. You're not going to go back and look through not only every page, but all of the coding information and make sure everything aligns with what the production value is. Our QC layers, both before we send it to our production team, as well as, I mean, we have a QA team. That's their entire job. They QA every aspect of the process. They QA your data when it is processed. They QA your data when it is produced. They QA a data overlay that we need to make for something. The goal of that is someone who has the knowledge of what it's supposed to look like is able to look at every step of the way and say, okay, we know we have this many documents that should be slip sheeted this way. Let's make sure that that matches, that the text is appropriate, that the metadata is removed or adjusted the way it's supposed to be because we're withholding this information. Those are things that, you know, on your end, you can do in a small firm for a very small set of data, but producing it in a standard ESI concordance DAT file. If I said concordance and I said UTF-8, you're not going to know what that is unless you work in technology in some capacity. Those are the kinds of big ads that we can do, is giving you the format that you need, the format that's appropriate and correct, and having the right number of people, the right teams to QC those steps along the way and make sure that you get what's right.
You can't self-QC either. It's when people say QC your own work, that's ridiculous. You cannot self-QC. It's like, I made the damn thing. Of course it's right.
And talking about QC, I mean, there's a very documented, extensive QC process that's been tried and tested. That value all in itself is huge and something that I honestly never had the appreciation for before I worked with you guys. When you hire others to help you with this, there's a damn good reason why you're paying the money that you're paying. And there's a really great way of QCing this that's going to protect you and your vendor for that matter.
One thing I will say too is a lot of firms and in-house teams just don't have the people power to be as elastic as you might need throughout the process. Some parts of this process are super time sensitive and heavy lift. And so you're going to have to scale that. And like an in-house team or for a law firm team, you know, they're probably just not going to be built for that because that's not what they're supposed to do. So hire a vendor.
I mean, this is one of those things that you can delegate out to experts. That's okay, because there's nothing that's subject matter expertise that's needed. Like Nate and Dan don't have to know what the lawsuit's about. They don't have to know like why you marked things the way that you did. That's not of importance to them.
We don't care. I've had one client that I've actually said that to because they were trying to talk me through a decision way late at night. And I was like, I don't care. I'm here for you if you have an issue, but I don't care. You make the decisions and then you tell me when it's ready and I've got you. We will produce it the way you say. But don't talk to me, well, you know, I looked at the document and I'm just curious, do you think this is privileged? No, I do not. I don't know. I have no idea what this is about. I don't want to know what this is about. We care about your production. We care about your work product, but we don't care about the reason behind that detail and subject matter expertise that you have and you're supposed to have.
I want to get under the hood because I kind of feel like we're in a mechanic shop, like picking apart production, because it's a very small little part of the whole EDRM spectrum, but it's so complicated. And production's kind of like one of those things, like you don't really appreciate it until you're there. The first thing I'd like to talk about are some of the time consuming aspects of production, because I think this is a value for our listeners that might be reaching out to get help. What should people know about how processing time affects production schedule?
More images, more time. The way you export images as well, like, you know, TIFF files export faster than searchable PDFs. So depending on what types of images you're exporting as well. I mean, I don't think it's so much machine time, unless it's a super big production, that's really going to slow down the entire thing. You know, most productions you could typically have exported in a couple hours. But when you get into the gigantic sets, it could take a lot longer.
It depends on if you're talking about just that process of production, the combination of machine and export, or if we're expanding to like the process of production, which is you hand it over and what happens now? And I've actually been asked by someone before, they're like, we're going to need this super fast. We know you said 24 hours, but we know that the approximate, can you just like save some stamping for us? I've literally been asked. And that to me showed that they have zero idea what they're talking about. There's no save space. It's not, we don't tell the production team like, hey, I need like 20,000 pages worth of machine time here for you.
Do they think you're printing stickers?
Like, I don't
understand.
So I'm pretty sure that they're envisioning the stamping where you would, you know, put your prefix and you'd roll page one and you'd flip and you'd roll page two, you know, stamping.
I mean, some of us did that, Nate. I mean, I'm just saying.
Did it, don't do it. That's the key, right? Like, did it once, don't do it anymore.
Yes.
But the process also comes from when you hand it off, we don't just turn around and get to kick it out. We have to look at it. We have to validate what needs natives, what is images only, what needs a slip sheet, what has native redactions, right? If you use a native redaction tool, there's specific workflows to make sure that your native Excel doesn't give them a bunch of stuff you didn't want. Or we're looking at that native Excel and it has an embedded email that some weirdo shoved into an Excel and you want that embedded email withheld, but you don't know that. And so you just go, wee! And we look at it and we go, well, hey, if you produce this Excel, you're handing them that native you said is privileged. And they go, what? And we're like, okay, let's show you how to redact that out of the Excel. There's processes to all of those pieces. Before that machine time that Dana was talking about, that can be quick. But if we just push the button go, you're going to get a sloppy mess. We have to have the time to go through the process. And again, I talked earlier about like, if you have a review team on our side, as soon as you hand it off, it doesn't even get to me yet. It goes back to the review manager who then gets to compare it to their coding and QCs and be like, oh, they downgraded 20% of the privilege. We've got to validate that now because it's our work product that they're saying is overprivileged or underprivileged, right? It's changed. And so all of those pieces add up. And then after the quicker than most of the other steps, branding and exporting dependent upon the type of exports, you're now getting into the QC steps that we talked about earlier.
So this next question, I originally put it under the heading, don't go chasing waterfalls, but I think we're actually going to invert that and say, do go chasing waterfalls. What I mean by that is best practices. Are there things like, what's your waterfall on every production? Is there a standard set of searches that you run before it goes out?
Each workspace is different, but a lot of the stuff will be the same. Like you're looking for privileged documents. You're looking for documents that say they have redactions, but might not. You're looking for documents that are imaged, aren't imaged, are imaged incorrectly. The goal is to tag the production with the universe and then click on each search. And if there's documents in each of these searches, it'll tell you there's something wrong with them. Like they're privileged and they need to be fixed. Or a lot of times down the road, they'll make new tags, et cetera, that don't get picked up in the searches. You'll start missing things if you don't really kind of reverse engineer what the search is doing to double check and make sure that you're catching everything that you need to catch. But that's what we refer to as the waterfall searches.
You touched on this a second ago when you said catch everything that you want to catch. Can you elaborate on that more? What are you trying to catch on the way out the door?
Okay, so there's different fields that our processing engine will spit out if there are comments, hidden comments, track changes, etc. When those are in the search, we know that those have to be imaged differently through our processing team so that we capture everything that they need to catch. That's one example. I mean, there's many things like completely privileged withhold. Obviously, like that's not going out in this production set.
So you're just trying to catch issues before they get out the door.
Everything. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. The goal of a waterfall, and I love the phrase waterfall because again, I didn't start in a tech-based world or a database-based world in the same way. But the idea is, and what you'll hear is the phrase, a dynamic search. And I like that as an idea because dynamic versus static is really easy. That goes outside of technology in the same way. If it's static, nothing's going to make a change. We save the list and it says, this is what's there. If it's dynamic, that means it is automatically changing based on the information that you're coding and tagging and stuff are changing. So we make dynamic searches where there's like a parent search, a top level search that has a tag that says, this is our production population. And then 5, 10, 25, I have an MDL that has gosh darn, probably near 75. I think actually Dano has another MDL that has like 75 for a different one. And it has more searches than you could ever imagine. Each one of those searches was built for a purpose. It was built to make sure that if a document says redacted, it actually contains redactions. You didn't miss it in your review. And so it actually has those. Or a document is tagged in one field, privilege, and this is what Dano was talking about. What about after you go through PQC? Maybe the first layers of a review, you didn't have the same like second level privilege QC where you were downgrading from a privilege log. And so now we're not running off of the same field that we were. We're now working off of this privilege QC field that might be different. And so we have to learn that and change those dynamic searches and pay attention and work, you know, with the handoff and your pencils down to know what fields you've been using so we can properly identify any and every issue that might exist in your production population.
Yeah. And that's sometimes how you can tell pencils are not down when these searches start building up more and more documents within them. You're like, wait a minute, this is changing.
So you want to stop the freight train before it leaves the station. You run these searches, you make sure the train is in fact ready to depart.
Mm-hmm.
In working with both Dan and Nate, because of their expertise in production and other things, there's expertly crafted searches that happen within the production world that you didn't even think about. And they're just standard practice for a vendor because this is what they do every day. So they're running these complex searches and their whole goal is to, number one, make sure that you're not missing anything, that you think that you've got it all covered, but you had no idea that there's gaps there. But number two, like Dan said, we really want to know if your real pencils are down. We've talked about the waterfall or the don't go chasing waterfalls, or should we chase waterfalls, or maybe I just want to get lost in a waterfall. I don't know. What other QC measures would you guys recommend other than those searches that we've already talked about?
I mean, I think we talked about those searches and we talked about, you know, kind of the post-production QC that happens after the export is there. We've got a QA team that runs through and make sure the deliverable matches what we expected, which is sadly oftentimes where we do catch people not being pencils down if they did it mid-production. I had a third-party PII review team that worked on a project that was known for it. Every single time we'd get the production to the finish line and then it would be going through its final QC and they'd be like, hey, coding's changed. And it was like, no, we don't care. We actually got to the point where we got approval from the council team to ignore coding changes after a certain point. Just ignore them. We don't care what happened. The other layer of QC is our handoff. So once you give it to us and we run this waterfall, we're going to come back to you with any questions we've got. And we expect you to answer those questions or your production will not happen. And I've had people say before, hey, why didn't we do this? And I'll look back and I'll be like, because you never confirmed you changed anything. Sorry, buddy. But so we go back and forth. We clear out all of these validation questions that might exist. We then put together a document and we've got one that our team uses and our department uses. And I imagine most vendors are going to have something similar. That's a table that we can put into an email that tells you, this is the prod volume. This is how many documents it is. This is how many pages it is. Here's how many redactions there are. Here's how many slip sheets there are. Here's the breakdown of the coding validations that we see. And then we send that off and we say, hey, here's a search to your production. And here's all of these details. We're good to go, right? We're confirming you if you one last time. We've done all of these validations and we want your sign off to move forward with the production as we see it.
I think a lot of times when you were talking about the validation forms and sending that information back to the client for their sign off, if it's in a document, I've noticed people don't like to open documents and read them. They just kind of like to say, it's good. They said it's good. It's good. Sometimes they don't look at these things. So communication is key. I mean, a lot of times you need to just talk to them and ask them, like, for instance, what are you redacting? And if they're redacting like email headers, you got to ask the deeper question. Do you want us to redact metadata now? Because you've redacted names from this file on the image, like email addresses, but they're still in the load file. So you're still going to be able to find out who sent or received that document. There's all kinds of little things you got to think about and communicate with your client so that you don't let them fail.
I feel like that's such an important point. Like people don't think about that. You know, you take something out, you redact it and you're like, good to go. And people don't think that the metadata is not redacted. And so that thing that you think you took out of your document, that privileged information, whatever that you think you took out, it's still there. or at least right. part of it is, you know, and it's some iteration of it is there and available for perusal by your enemies.
Yeah. File names, et cetera.
I think metadata redactions are such a good point because I think it's one of the most under focused on portions of a review. Recognizing just because you took it off of what you can see doesn't mean you took it off of what can be searched and identified. If we're doing a true production, and I think that's part of the issue, is people who have been doing it for a long time, especially if they work in smaller projects mostly, they're used to doing it on their own, and they're used to doing it in a program like Adobe, where they are flattening everything into a PDF, and they're just hand-drawing redactions, and, you know, Adobe has the ability to apply stamping at a certain level, and they're sending over PDFs. And that doesn't match current, you know, e-discovery standards. That doesn't match ESI protocols for pretty much any, I would say state, but I would go to country. You know, internationally, that's not going to match what you need. But in a lot of these small court programs and a lot of these small kind of, you know, they're giving to small firms back and forth. They're so used to it not mattering that when they get to a bigger one, they're like, yeah, whatever, we're just doing a production. And we're giving them 10, 15 metadata fields that contain mm-hmm. the appropriate information to show we collected it from mm-hmm. the original source. Did you make sure that that same information that you drew off the face of the image is actually gone?
Lawyers, we have a duty to provide a level of competence to our clients. And so if you, as the lawyer, are not technologically a genius as far as production goes, you know, if you're not in the weeds with it, you have an ethical duty to outsource that to somebody who is, so that clients' documents that you're producing meet the standard of care. Full yeah. stop.
And so we've had a common theme throughout this whole EDRM series that Angie and I have been recording, which is the ESI protocol. As much as we all loathe the ESI protocol at times, you know, Nate just kind of hinted to the importance of that, because that's one of the first things that a good project manager will ask for, because they're concerned that you are meeting all the requirements that you've agreed to meet and that we're following the format that you've agreed to produce things in. And that's kind of like the guiding light here of what we're trying to accomplish. What are some common ESI protocol provisions that folks should look out for, and how can they impact the step of production here, guys?
The best thing you can do for yourself, in my opinion, is get a vendor while you're still building out the ESI protocol. And I think that that's contrary to what a lot of people do, but the best projects that I've had myself, as well as one of our forensics experts if we're doing the collections, as well as one of our review managers if we're doing the review, we look over the ESI protocol and we can give you insight based upon our opinions. And that's what really helps you with catching those things that are major pitfalls in an ESI. And I'll say outside of production, the one that's near and dear to my heart, because I have to yell at everybody about it right now, is if you ever have someone who is asking for what's called modern attachments or hyperlinks.
Oh my gosh. It is the red flag. I was gonna go there.
And it's not production specific. It is the bane of my existence. Look at the StubHub decision that was made in the last month. Greatest positive movement towards the hyperlink negation of relevancy as a modern attachment. It is not an attachment based upon how prevalent and the way in which links are listed. But that's a thing you don't know. That's a thing that you as a lawyer, hopefully you know, that production fields, all of those things. I'll stop with hyperlinks, but you're not expected to know everything. And I know that law schools generally are not really teaching e-discovery to lawyers for the most part still.
They don't. And it's which is scary. A shame.
Our job is to know it. So Dano, I'm going to let you take everything about ESI protocols with productions, because I just want to say, talk to us beforehand. Don't wait for production. Don't give us a finished ESI protocol. Reach out to us and say, we have a project we're going to need. Come to us for consultancy, because that's what we're here for. Yeah.
Can I yes and you and then flip it to Dan? Because I want to not lose this thread. Depending on your jurisdiction, courts have different views on this and they are more or less draconian about it. But if you agree to an ESI protocol that you cannot actually do, like you don't have the technological capability to do it, some courts say, fine, then you get sanctioned. Some courts kind of waffle about it. Like I know there have been some decisions out of California lately that have been a little bit calling that into question, but you could get slapped for it. to you, Dan, on that happy note.
No, we definitely see some weird ESI protocols coming through. I just had one the other day when I came back, had to make changes because they wanted a native production, all native. That's fine. First round was eDocs, no big deal. Second round, I noticed we had just emails. I'm like, I'm not producing these natively. You're crazy. So I looked through again and it said, yeah, we can produce images, but it's our last resort. And I said, well, you're getting your last resort because these are emails and we're not getting these out natively. So
they fought you on that. They argued for sending their emails and you beat them down. It was a good job.
Yeah, sometimes you just have to make the call on these things and explain why. And they'll usually work with you.
Well, talk more about that, Dan, because I'm sure we have people that are new to eDiscovery that are like, well, what's the problem with just producing my emails? Like, why would we not want to do that?
Well, you don't want to accidentally open one and send it or modify it and change it. You know, you're going to freak someone out if you send a 7-year-old email. You don't want to get into that situation. So
anything that has an external effect, anything that has a link and or the ability to be sent is not something you want to open the world to access for.
Mm-hmm. And typically, when you're told to give a native production, I think it's because these people don't know how to load TIFF images into a relational database. They want to just get this file and open these documents and look at them and, you know, go from there. You can always argue the fact like, look, you don't need emails. We can send you PDFs. They're just as easy to open. You're still going to see the email. You're just not going to accidentally send this to someone else. So,
I mean, this is sort of, I'm going to take us on a little bit of a tangent here, but I think it's really important both on the vendor side and the client side to ask why. Everyone is coming at this with a slightly different area of expertise and a slightly different background and a slightly different knowledge base. Take your pride out of it. I feel like the more I learn, the more comfortable I am with what I don't know, right? And this was really hard for me in my early career to ask why, because you want to have all the answers and know everything, but you should ask these questions, ask the baseline stuff like, hey, I don't understand, what's the problem with sending this in a native format? Very valid questions. And it's so much better to ask and temporarily feel like an idiot than it is to send the thing out and then really feel like an idiot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love the idea of contacting you guys first and involving you in the ESI protocol creation phase, because it is something that is highly overlooked. And the reason why it's highly overlooked is usually legal counsel and paralegals and all the people involved are like, we just got sued and we're fighting about what keywords we're going to be running through this data and what's even at stake and who are the people involved and holy crap, or how much money are we going to have to come out of our pocket with because we're responsible or we're not responsible? Like, what is our stance on this? And do we have to talk to the media and do we have to do all that? Like, they're totally preoccupied with all these things that you need to consider at the onslaught of litigation that nobody's thinking about. 6 months to a year from now, we might be talking to our vendor about production. And it might be good to make sure before we sign off on this ESI protocol that we can actually do what it says that we can do. And I understand the dilemma, but you guys are absolutely right. Consulting you up front is definitely preferable because so many times you guys are saving the client from themselves.
The cost of your litigation can swing by millions of dollars depending on what is in your ESI protocol.
Yep.
Like, if you do not structure that in a way that is advantageous to the way that your data is stored and the data that you have, it can literally cost millions in attorney and vendor fees. Definitely bring people to the table and ask questions. Being caught flat-footed, being caught in a position where you have suddenly agreed to produce all this metadata or data, and the only way you can do it is by manually reviewing 3 terabytes of documents. I mean, that's horrifying, right? Yeah. That's millions of dollars right there. I feel like I'm really getting on my soapbox.
No,
side note, I'm flat-footed and I've never heard that saying before. And now I'm like a little offended.
Oh my God, I'm so sorry.
It's the right soapbox to get on, Angie, because it is pure and simple. If you agree to not utilize active learning or to not utilize search terms correctly, or you have to manual review XYZ, like, you're agreeing to something you don't even know the context of because discovery isn't there. And the downstream effects of not setting up your ESI protocol correctly is detrimental. And I would say, Angie, I want my lawyers to learn from you.
Let's close this out on a fun note. Fun with an asterisk and several disclaimers, because I want to talk about the big bad P word, privilege. So obviously, when you run a production, the goal is to avoid producing privileged ESI. But here's my question to you, Dan and Nate. How often does privileged material get produced? And how does that happen? And what can you do about it?
Not often. If it is often, it's a weird thing or pencils weren't down. Like I say, coding changes, we'll let that happen if it happens after the fact. Sometimes redactions are missed because there's a field that says document supposed to have redactions, but they actually didn't and it slipped through the cracks. That doesn't really happen though. I can't remember the last time bad privilege went out. There are some situations where you might have a document that, let's say for instance, the processing didn't provide text and that didn't get picked up in processes along the way. And that document goes out with the whole set. And for some reason, the word, whatever, didn't pop up and that privileged document went out. It has to be something like that because we really do go through a lot of checks. We have an entire QC team that goes through these things and looks for even common priv terms. And I don't see it a lot.
Yeah, because we don't just look at your coding, you know, depending upon the project and things like that. We've worked with you on priv screens. And I think the big key word to what you said, though, also, Dan, was bad priv. True, obvious priv is pretty rare if you have a good review support team and you have a vendor running your productions. It should be extremely rare. Borderline priv is where things get hard, where it gets a decision made by a reviewer. And those are things that are outside of my context, right? That's, like I said, I will never code your documents, thank the Lord. But I know that those things happen because I watch priv QC workflows where things are being upgraded and downgraded. And I know that there are borderline priv decisions being made all the time. Those, I would say, in a large production, right? Like 10, 15 documents, is not what we're talking about. We're talking about a minimum of 500 to 1,000 documents. Over that, the likelihood that there's something that is considered borderline privilege is high, but that's contextual. And it was decided by whoever did that QC that it's priv, but that may be changed later. And that's what gets scary, is sometimes one person thinks it's this way, another person thinks it this way, both on the council team, and later on they decide, oh, this should have been or shouldn't have been, the priv screen should have changed.
So let's talk about what parties can do when that happens, because obviously you're going to have some human error, and making these privilege calls can be really complicated. Everything is fact specific, and there are a number of different kinds of privilege, and the law of your jurisdiction might be changing, or pick a factor that could affect this. This does happen, but what can parties do if they inadvertently produce privileged material?
Typically, you depend on what you produced. You would talk about that with your client, and they'll either go back and ask for that document to be clawed back and or provide a replacement. If it's just one document and a redaction needed to be put in place, we would basically fix that one document so that we don't have to provide a whole entire new set. Kind of sucks. And that's where we get into the situation we talked about earlier where you've got a muddy workspace. That's probably the most common thing I see after production's already been delivered.
So what is a clawback? Can you break that down for our listeners?
Basically, where you go back and ask for a document to be deleted from the workspace, including all metadata, any network iterance of the document where they have it stored on a network as well. So when you have a production, you don't just put it into the database. It's also living on the network somewhere as it was delivered. So you want to make sure that you get every piece of that privileged document removed from their systems, and then you provide a replacement. And they'll just basically overlay that into the production volume on their relational database.
Couple things about that I want to kind of break down a little bit more. So this clawback that you've talked about, this is typically an agreement between parties, right? That they'll negotiate before a production goes out. We're not slapping a Band-Aid on after the fact. This is prophylactic.
I'm sure that's in most all agreements, but even if you don't have that agreement, I'm not sure the ethical standards, I mean, y'all attorneys would know better than I do as far as how to work that out. But with good faith, I think you can probably say, hey, look, we screwed up. And you do it quickly in a timely manner, they're gonna agree with you and say, okay, fine, we'll take that out. We peeked at it, but we obviously can't use it now. So
yeah.
And there are things like that, yeah, right? Like you can't produce something and then be super dilatory and 3 years later be like, mulligan. You know, it doesn't work like that.
A clawback is not a small thing. That's why the big faux pas, like you said, it's the big bad P word, is to produce privilege. I would say a lot of people love to blame their vendor for it, especially if their vendor was the review team. But there's a reason that we do so many samples and QCs along the way with the council team, because even our review teams, they still are humans and they are not the case expert like you are. And so we have to have those QC checks. We run those term highlight sets to help our review teams while noting that some documents don't highlight as well, or that, you know, some documents, if it's in the text, it'll only highlight in the text because in the native, it doesn't actually show. And that makes people angry, but it's a reality of technology. And it's the reason we need you as the subject matter expert to do those QCs along the way to flag, oh, we learned this firm is now, you know, we didn't realize they used to be their attorneys 10 years ago. So we need to add them to the potentially privileged set.
Well, I just want to thank you, Dan and Nate, for being here to share your expertise, because I know you guys take it for granted what you actually know and how valuable what you know is to other people that don't deal with production, as one example. But you guys, of course, deal with all aspects of e-discovery on a daily basis. We appreciate you and your expertise tonight. I want to ask you both, in terms of production, because that is our topic of the evening, is there anything that you want to have as a parting thought, or just a tip or trick or a piece of advice that you'd like to leave with our listeners before we sign off?
I think communicate with your clients, be preemptive, pad your timing if you can, and don't stress them out about their pencils down. When you rush them, they make mistakes, even though they're done. They're not done. They'll call you back at 3 a.m. and say, wait, you know, take this out or add this doc or something. There's a lot going on. And you kind of got to let them relax a little bit so that they don't freak out on you and start making dumb mistakes. Buffer your time if you can. We always say 24 to 48 hour turnaround time on you know, standard size production sets. If I can tell a client's going to be in the weeds, working through things late and kind of working from behind, I'll tell them 48 hours.
I would say the biggest thing from all perspectives, whether you're new to being a PM or at a vendor or a firm, you know, your e-discovery counselor, you're a lawyer, don't think of production as only being at the end. The production is it. It's the final package. It's everything you've been working for. So you should be thinking about the production the day that you're collecting data. You should be thinking about what is it we are hoping to have, what is it we're expecting to have as we're reviewing, what are the sizes and the timelines we're expecting to have. If we know like the end is on a certain day, don't plan on that production being finished that day. That gives you no cushion of time. Plan on that production being 2 days or a week or 2 weeks, depending upon the size, so that when things aren't perfect, because humans aren't perfect, because looking at thousands, if not tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of documents is not perfect, you give yourself the time for that change, because you're looking and you're thinking about the deliverable starting at the very beginning.
I think those are great pieces of advice. And guys, I just want to thank you not only for being here tonight, but thank you for being the dudes in the middle of the night when somebody's like, okay, oh my God, I just went through review for like the fifth time and we did all the things that we were supposed to do like a week ago and we were too busy to do. And oh my God, thank you for being patient with me. Okay, could you sacrifice your life to put this production on and it's like 2 a.m.? And you're having to put your family aside, your whatever, your personal time aside. And that's part of what it means to be a project manager. And you guys are both great at it. And it's a huge sacrifice. So I just want to say thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. Thank you, Dan. Thank you, Nate. And listeners, don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Give us a 5-star review and tell your friends, family, and coworkers about us. And of course, please hit us up on LinkedIn or at admin@ediscoverychicks.com with your thoughts, questions, and drink recommendations.
And before we go, we want to remind our listeners to join us in September in Pasadena, California. Angie and I will be speaking in person at the Techno Security West Conference. It'll be the week of September the 16th. Angie and I are actually speaking on the 17th, but you'll want to come hang with us before and after. We look forward to meeting you in person. Please don't miss an opportunity for great e-discovery content, forensics, cybersecurity, and all the good stuff at Techno Security West in September.
Until next time.
Bye.
Bye.